attached to a chance mechanism, with the daily probability of detonation increasing as the enemy moves from wire to wire. The critical feature of the analogy, it should be emphasized, is that whether or not the tripwire detonates general war is, at least to some extent, outside our control, and the Russians know it. The same interpretation might be true of Quemoy. One can argue that the Chinese or Russians were deterred by the prospect of major war, not just by the prospect of losing a limited war or winning one at excessive cost. Even if they were convinced that we would exercise every skill and caution to keep a war limited, and they were prepared to exercise skill and caution themselves, they may simply have felt that the process that leads to bigger and bigger wars is not one that they or we fully understand or can foresee, and that the risk, though numerically small, was appreciable. Risky behavior in limited war. If one of the functions of limited war, then, is to pose the deliberate risk of all-out war, in order to intimidate the enemy and to make pursuit of his limited objectives intolerably risky to him, the usual precepts for behavior in limited war need revision. The supreme objective may not be to assure that it stays limited, but rather to keep the risk of all-out war within moderate limits above zero. At least this may be the strategy for the side that is in danger of losing a limited war. The less likely it is that the enemy's aggressive advances can be contained by limited and local resistance, the more reason there may be to fall back upon the deliberate creation of mutual risk. Alternatively, the more the aggressor can design his advances so that even local resistance seems fraught with explosive potential, the less attractive local resistance will seem. Deliberately raising the risk of all-out war is thus a tactic that fits the context of limited war. Of course, one cannot raise the risk just by saying so. One cannot just announce to the enemy that yesterday one was only about 2% ready to go to all-out war, but today it is 7%, and they had better watch out. One has to take actions that, assuming he and his adversary continue to be just as concerned and careful to keep the war limited, leave everyone just a little less sure that the war can be kept under control. The idea is simply that a limited war can get out of hand by degrees. At any point, one has some notion or sensation of how much out of control it is. And various actions, innovations, breaches of limits, manifestations of irresponsibility, challenging and assertive acts, adoption of a menacing strategic posture, adoption of headstrong allies and collaborators, spoofing and harassing tactics, introduction of new weapons, enlargement of troop commitments or the area of conflict, tend to raise almost anyone's judgment of how much out of control the situation is. To share such an increase in risk with an enemy may provide him an overpowering incentive to lay off. Preferably, one creates the shared risk by irreversible maneuvers or commitments, so that only the enemy's withdrawal can tranquilize the situation. Otherwise, it may turn out to be a contest of nerves. Reprisal and harassment. Limited local war is not the only context in which deliberately risky behavior may be used as a type of threat. Between the threats of massive retaliation and of limited war, there is the possibility of less than massive retaliation, of graduated reprisal. Few serious analyses of war of limited reprisal have been published. The idea that one might take out a Russian city if Soviet troops invade a country and keep taking out one every day until they quit has been occasionally adverted to journalistically, but not systematically explored. Similar in spirit is the idea of hostile action on a small scale, sinking ships, blockading ports, jamming communications, or whatever it may be. There are a number of Russian actions of an aggressive or hostile sort that might provide neither locale for a limited war nor the dramatic act to trigger massive retaliation. Efforts to harass, blackmail, or blockade neutral countries or American allies. a peacetime campaign to jam our early warning and other radar, tricks with nuclear weapons as part of a war of nerves, instigation of sabotage in NATO countries, flagrant support of insurrection, or even the use of unaccustomed violence in quelling disturbances within their own satellites. It may do little good to combat these actions by like measures of our own. It may also not be wise to insist that we are about to boil over into massive retaliation. If something were to be done, the deliberate creation of a small but appreciable shared risk of general war might be considered. Or, if not, at least the purpose and significance of Soviet mischief may need to be interpreted as an effort to intimidate by the creation of a shared risk of general war. How do we interpret a dramatic act like, say, limited nuclear reprisal on enemy territory? As in limited war, there again may be two parts to the cost imposed on an enemy. One is a direct cost, casualties, destruction, humiliation, or whatever it may be. The other is the created risk of all-out war. Nobody quite knows what happens if one country explodes a nuclear weapon in an enemy country. If the action is recognized as an isolated act, limited in intent, not part of a massive attack nor of a sneak attack against the other's retaliatory capability, the victim may not see wisdom in unleashing all-out war in response to the pain and insult. But, even if he does not, he is likely to do something that in turn will have consequences that may ultimately reach a stage of all-out war. If the response is simply to strike back in like fashion, the process may taper off, or it may explode. So even if each side prefers to act cautiously, failure to understand completely how each other reacts might bring about a dynamic process that ultimately explodes into all-out war. The odds may still be against it. Here again, we are dealing with an action that may or may not bring about general war, the final outcome not being under the complete control of the participants, the probability of all-out war being a matter of judgment. To mention these possibilities is not necessarily to propose them, but to indicate how they should be interpreted. The sanction they impose on the victim, one that the threatener shares with him, is the recognizable increase in the likelihood of total war. Risky behavior and compellent threats. There is typically a difference between a threat intended to make an adversary do something or cease doing something, and a threat intended to keep him from starting something. The distinction is in the timing, in who has to make the first move, in whose initiative is put to the test. To deter by threat an enemy's advance, it may be enough to burn the bridges behind me as I face the enemy. To compel by threat an enemy's retreat, I have to be committed to move forward, and this requires setting fire to the grass behind me with the wind blowing toward the enemy. I can block your car in the road by placing my car in your way. My deterrent threat is passive. The decision to collide is up to you. If you, however, find me in your way and threaten to collide unless I move, you enjoy no such advantage. The decision to collide is still yours, and I enjoy deterrence. You have to arrange to have to collide unless I move, and that is a degree more complicated. The threat that compels rather than deters, therefore, often takes the form of administering the punishment until the other acts, rather than if he acts. This is so because often the only way to become physically committed to an action is to initiate it. Initiating steady pain, even if the threatener shares the pain, may make sense as a threat, especially if the threatener can initiate it irreversibly so that only the other's compliance can relieve the pain they both share. But irreversibly initiating certain disaster, if one shares it, is no good. Irreversibly initiating a moderate risk of mutual disaster, however, if the other's compliance is feasible within a short enough period to keep the cumulative risk within tolerable bounds, may be a means of scaling down the threat to where one is willing to set it going. Subjecting the enemy and oneself to a 1% risk of enormous disaster for each week that he fails to comply is somewhat similar to subjecting him and oneself to a steady weekly damage rate equivalent to 1% of disaster. The words somewhat and equivalent may be interpreted very flexibly here. Rocking the boat is a good example. If I say, row, or I'll tip the boat over and drown us both, you'll say you don't believe me. But if I rock the boat so that it may tip over, you'll be more impressed. If I can't administer pain short of death for the two of us, a little bit of death in the form of a small probability that the boat will tip over is a near equivalent. But to make it work, I must really put the boat in jeopardy. Just saying that I may turn us both over is unconvincing. Ideally, for this purpose, I should have a little black box that contains a roulette wheel and a device that will detonate in a way that unquestionably provokes total war. I then set this little box down, tell the Russians that I have set it going so that once a day the roulette wheel will spin with a given probability, numerically specified and known to the Russians, that on any day the little box will provoke total war. I tell them, demonstrate to them, that the little box will keep running until my demands have been complied with, and that there is nothing I can do to stop it. Note that I do not insist that I shall decide on total war or initiate it deliberately if the box hits the critical combination. I leave it all up to the box, which automatically engulfs us both in war if the right or wrong combination comes up on any day. Given the fact that even if the enemy complies, there is some risk that the box detonates war before he has a chance to collect himself and do our bidding, there is an advantage in making it less than certain that the box will explode on any given day. In ordinary deterrence, where nothing happens unless the enemy acts contrary to our demand, to threaten too much may be superfluous, but not self-defeating. In the present case, where the threat starts fulfilling itself at a specified rate over time as soon as we commit ourselves to it, too big a threat can defeat its purpose. In this situation, the small probability threat is not just a possible substitute for the large certain threat. It is a superior and necessary alternative. Take an example. A European country, having acquired a modest nuclear retaliatory force, tells the Russians to get out of Hungary, or it will work terrible damage on the USSR. The Russians ignore the threat, since there is no persuasive way for the threatening country to make itself have to do anything so suicidal. Alternatively, the country threatens to send a missile a day over the USSR with a nuclear weapon and a random device that explodes it somewhere over Russia if it hasn't been shot down. The Russians say they do not believe the country would do it. The country does it. The Russians protest and threaten. A day passes. The country does it again. Maybe one weapon gets through and detonates. Maybe several do. Maybe none do. If some do, maybe they burst over cities. Maybe over populated countryside. Maybe over deserted areas. The country keeps it up. What is the country doing? The principal thing the country is doing, in addition to damaging or humiliating Russia, is incurring a painful risk that both it and Russia, and the rest of the world, will be engaged in all-out war in the near future, a war that neither it nor Russia wants. The country is saying, in effect, if you do not get out of Hungary, we may cause an all-out war to occur. But when must the Russians get out? The sooner they get out, the sooner the risk of war from this cause will be terminated or reduced. The country applying the pressure is not saying, get out or we shall deliberately start a war. The decision is not up to them, and does not depend on their displaying the manifest resolution for a final act. The Russians may suppose that the country concerned will do everything it can to prevent total war. But they also have to recognize that with these things flying around, exploding now and then, and with themselves responding in whatever way they feel obliged to, it is not altogether clear that the country concerned and the Russians know how to keep total war from occurring. This illustration is intended just as an analogy for other actions in which posing a risk of all-out war may not be so recognizable as an integral part of what is happening. To take a more immediate situation, suppose an armored column were sent to Berlin in the event that ground access were denied. Or suppose, once a transport squeeze on Berlin became intolerable, troops were sent in to claim and hold a corridor. Suppose actions were taken that, whether intended to or not, generated some likelihood of an East German uprising. How do we analyze the nature of the pressure on the Russians? I think the answer is in large part that they are confronted with a risk of war that both sides badly want not to occur, but that both sides may not be able to prevent. A rationale for direct action, even on a scale that by itself might accomplish little, could be the deliberate creation of a risk that we share with the Russians, providing them with the option either to terminate the risk by acting or to withdraw to meet our objectives. This is not the only interpretation of such action, of course. It may be that we could win militarily if the fight stays on a small scale, and for the Russians to enlarge it would require a discontinuous jump that they would be deterred from taking for fear of provoking a discontinuous response. In that case, the initial limited war would contain a deterrent threat against enlargement of the war. Even so, an important reason why the threat of even small-scale war might be effective is that such a war promises a small but appreciable increase in the probability of an enormous war, the probability being small enough that the Russians believe the West could bring itself to create it, large enough to make it unprofitable for them to let it occur. It is worth noting that this interpretation suggests that the threat of limited war may be potent even when there is little expectation that we would win it. In these terms, a limited local war is not just local military action. It contains an element of retaliation on the Soviet homeland, not a small bit of retaliation, but a small probability of a massive war. Brinkmanship. The argument of this paper leads to a definition of brinkmanship and a concept of the brink of war. The brink is not, in this view, the sharp edge of a cliff where one can stand firmly, look down, and decide whether or not to plunge. The brink is a curved slope that one can stand on with some risk of slipping. The slope gets steeper and the risk of slipping greater as one moves toward the chasm. But the slope and the risk of slipping are rather irregular. Neither the person standing there nor onlookers can be quite sure just how great the risk is, or how much it increases when one takes a few more steps downward. One does not, in brinkmanship, frighten the adversary who is roped to him by getting so close to the edge that if one decides to jump, one can do so before anyone can stop him. Brinkmanship involves getting onto the slope where one may fall in spite of his own best efforts to save himself, dragging his adversary with him. Brinkmanship is thus the deliberate creation of a recognizable risk of war, a risk that one does not completely control. It is the tactic of deliberately letting the situation get somewhat out of hand, just because its being out of hand may be intolerable to the other party and force his accommodation. It means harassing and intimidating an adversary by exposing him to a shared risk, or deterring him by showing that if he makes a contrary move, he may disturb us so that we slip over the brink whether we want to or not, carrying him with us. The idea that we should keep the enemy guessing about our response, particularly about whether we shall respond, needs an interpretation along these lines. It is sometimes argued that we need not threaten the enemy with the certainty of retaliation or the certainty of resistance, but just scare him with the possibility that we may strike back. This idea may be misconceived if it means confronting the Russians with a possible response that remains for us to decide on, one way or the other. The Russians may guess that after the event we should prefer not to strike back, particularly if they perform their aggression in moderate bites. And if we are unwilling to arrange so that we have to strike back, and are even unwilling to say that we certainly shall, we may seem to confirm their understanding of what our preference would be if we left ourselves any escape. So, if we are afraid that an absolute commitment to the threat might fail in its purpose and commit us to an action we prefer not to be committed to, there may be little to salvage by trying to persuade the enemy that we just might decide to do it anyway. But the situation is different if we get into a position where it is clear to the Russians that we are sufficiently involved that, while we probably have a way out, we may not. To say that we may or may not retaliate for an invasion of some neutral country, depending on how it suits us at the time, and that we shall not let the enemy make this decision for us, nor let him know just what to expect, may confront the enemy with what appears to be a bluff. But to get so involved in or near a neutral country with troops or other commitments that we are not altogether sure ourselves about whether we could evade a fight in case of invasion may genuinely keep the enemy guessing. In sum, it may make sense to try to keep the enemy guessing as long as we are not trying to keep him guessing about our own motivation. If the outcome is partly determined by events and processes that are manifestly somewhat beyond our comprehension and control, we create genuine risk for him. The imperfect process of decision. Underlying this threat that one may retaliate or precipitate war, the decision being somewhat beyond his control, is the notion that some of the most momentous decisions of government are taken by a process that is not entirely predictable, not fully under control, not altogether deliberate. It implies that a nation can get even into a major war somewhat inadvertently, by a decision process that might be called imperfect, in the sense that the response to particular contingencies cannot exactly be foretold by any advanced calculations, that the response to a particular contingency may depend on certain random or haphazard processes, or that there will be faulty information, faulty communication, misunderstanding, misuse of authority, panic, or human or mechanical failure. This idea does not reflect an unusually cynical view of the decision process. In the first place, decisions do have to be taken on the basis of incomplete evidence and ambiguous warning, and it is unreasonable to deny, in principle, the possibility of an irrevocable action taken on a false alarm. Furthermore, one need not be obsessed with the likelihood of false alarm to recognize that there may be levels below which this particular danger cannot be pushed without incurring other dangers that outweigh it. Second, war can occur because both sides become committed to irreconcilable positions from which neither is willing to back down, particularly if backing down requires assuming, even momentarily, a condition of military vulnerability. And it takes no cynic to recognize that two governments may misjudge each other's commitments. But in the third place, even an orderly government with responsible, comparatively cool-headed leaders is necessarily an imperfect decision system, especially in crises. This is so for a number of reasons, one of which is that in anything but a completely centralized dictatorship, a number of persons participate in a decision, and they do not have identical value systems, judgments of enemy intentions, and estimates of military capabilities. A decision taken quickly in crisis may depend on who is present, on whether particular studies have been completed, on the initiative and forcefulness shown by particular leaders and counselors who are reacting to a quite unprecedented stimulus. Some parts of the decision may be taken on delegated authority, and the person to whom the decision is delegated cannot necessarily reproduce the decision that would have been reached by a president or premier or cabinet in consultation with congressional or parliamentary leaders. There may even be some necessary contradictions in the decision process, such as constitutional issues that cannot be settled in advance, but that make it difficult to prepare fully for certain contingencies, because the necessity to break law or precedent can be accepted only implicitly, not explicitly prepared for. Finally, the need to keep secrets puts limits on the amount of advance preparation for contingencies that can be carried out. For this reason, there is no such thing as a firm plan, intention, or policy of a government to cover every contingency, even all important foreseeable contingencies. How the considerations add up, what interests are brought to bear, and how the collective decision procedure works in future crises is simply not fully determinable in advance. If on top of this we recognize that there are ordinary human limitations on the intellectual and emotional ability of governmental decision makers during the conduct of dangerous maneuvers on the brink of war, it ought to be clear that there is such a thing as getting into a situation from which it looks as though the nation may successfully extricate itself, but in which there is some appreciable risk that, try as it does within the limits it allows itself, it may not succeed. One does not expect a government to call attention to its own failings in this regard and to communicate to an enemy that this incomplete mastery of its own actions is an integral part of its strategy. There are also powerful public relations reasons for not pointing out to an enemy that one is even slightly susceptible to disastrous errors in judgment and false alarms, or that one is a little unsure how to escape from a risky situation. It is understandable, too, that a government engaged in limited war does not state that it has been attracted to this military action by the possible risk of all-out war that it entails. The point is that these things go without saying. But the basic idea of a threat that leaves something to chance is important even if we do not consciously use it ourselves, even tacitly. In the first place, it may be used against us. In the second place, we may misjudge some of the tactics we do use if we fail to recognize the presence of a risk of total war ingredient that may be a significant part of our influence on the enemy, even if we have never appreciated it. If, to take an example, this is an important part of the role of limited war forces in Europe, our analysis of that role may be seriously mistaken if we do not recognize it. The usual idea that a tripwire either does work or does not work, that the Russians either expect it to work or expect it not to work, is mistaking two simple extremes for a more complicated range of probabilities. Part 4. Surprise Attack, A Study in Mutual Distrust. Chapter 9. The Reciprocal Fear of Surprise Attack. If I go downstairs to investigate a noise at night with a gun in my hand and find myself face to face with a burglar who has a gun in his hand, there is danger of an outcome that neither of us desires. Even if he prefers just to leave quietly, and I wish him to, there is a danger that he may think I want to shoot, and shoot first. Worse, there is danger that he may think that I think he wants to shoot, or he may think that I think he thinks I want to shoot, and so on. Self-defense is ambiguous when one is only trying to preclude being shot in self-defense. This is the problem of surprise attack. If surprise carries an advantage, it is worthwhile to avert it by striking first. Fear that the other may be about to strike and the mistaken belief that we are about to strike gives us a motive for striking and so justifies the other's motive. But if the gains from even successful surprise are less desired than no war at all, there is no fundamental basis for an attack by either side. Nevertheless, it looks as though a modest temptation on each side to sneak in a first blow, a temptation too small by itself to motivate an attack, might become compounded through a process of interacting expectations, with additional motive for attack being produced by successive cycles of he thinks we think, he thinks we think. He thinks we think he'll attack, so he thinks we shall, so he will. So we must. It is interesting that this problem, though it arises most dramatically in situations that would usually be characterized as conflict, like that between the Russians and us or between the burglar and me, is logically equivalent to the problem of two or more partners who lack confidence in each other. If each is under some temptation to abscond with the joint assets, if each has a little suspicion that the other may be contemplating the same thing, if each realizes that the other may suspect too, and may suspect himself the object of suspicion, we have a payoff matrix identical with that of a surprise attack problem. If the heat is on some members of the mob, the rest of the mob may be tempted to rub them out to keep them from squealing, and those in danger may be tempted to squeal in self-defense. So, the game structure of preclusive self-defense is the same as that of partnership confidence. The intuitive idea that initial probabilities of surprise attack become larger may generate a multiplier effect as a result of this compounding of each person's fear of what the other fears is what I want to analyze in this chapter. More particularly, I want to analyze whether and how this phenomenon can arise through a rational calculation of probabilities or a rational choice of strategy by two players who appreciate the nature of their predicament. The intuitive idea itself, even if misconceived, may be a real phenomenon and motivate behavior. People may vaguely think they perceive that the situation is inherently explosive and respond by exploding. But what I want to explore is whether this phenomenon of compound expectations can be represented as a rational process of decision. Can we build an explicit model of this predicament in which two rational players are victims of the logic that governs their expectations of each other? Infinite series of probabilities. We might begin by trying to set up the problem as follows. A player operates on a set of probabilities, a potentially infinite series of them. First is the estimated probability, P sub 1, that the other party really prefers to attack, that is, that the other will attack even if he does not fear an attack himself. Second is the probability, P sub 2, that the other player thinks that I really prefer to attack him. That is, that I will attack him even if I do not fear an attack on me. Third is the probability, P sub 3, that he thinks I think he really would. Fourth is the probability, P sub 4, that he thinks I think he thinks I really would. Fifth, sixth, seventh, and so on are built up by lengthening the train of he thinks and I think with a separate probability attached to each member of the series. The overall probability that he will attack is then given by 1 minus the quantity 1 minus P sub 1 times the quantity 1 minus P sub 2 times the quantity 1 minus P sub 3, and so on. The trouble with this formulation is that nothing generates the series. Each probability is an ad hoc estimate, reflecting additional data about the specific information structure of the particular situation. We cannot, starting with a few terms in the series as data, project the rest to infinity, or however far it goes, and operate mathematically on the whole series. The number of terms in such a series can be only as much as a player has time to estimate, or the intellectual stamina to keep in mind, since he has to produce each new term of the series by an independent estimating process. It is true we might set up particular games with information structures that would yield a formula for the series. For example, a series of spins of a roulette wheel determine whether the other player is told my true value system, whether I am told whether he has been told, whether he is told whether I have been told what he was told, and so forth. But these would be special games, and might not illuminate much the general situation we are trying to come to grips with. What we need is a formulation of the problem that permits us to work with a limited number of arbitrary parameters, representing perhaps the initial or objective terms in a series, in a context that automatically generates the values of any additional probabilities that may be conceived of through the indefinite reiteration of "he thinks, I think." We need to formulate the problem in a way that makes each person's expectations a function of the others. A strictly soluble non-cooperative game. As a first try, we can assign to each of the two players a basic parameter representing the likelihood that he would attack if he should not. The values of these parameters are to be fully known and known to be known by both players. What I mean by "should not" is contained in the following two-part behavior hypothesis. The first part of our behavior hypothesis is that if the two players both perceive that a joint policy of no attack is the best of all possible outcomes for both of them, they will recognize this solution and elect to abstain. If, for example, the payoff matrix is as shown in Figure 19 in the supplement, each will have confidence in their mutual confidence and will elect the strategy that yields both players the best possible outcome. This seems to be a fairly modest demand on the rationality of the two players. It is a questionable one, I suppose, mainly if the superiority of joint no attack over unilateral surprise attack is small, too small to make both players completely confident that they understand each other. Now, this possibility, that somebody will be tempted to break discipline just to be on the safe side, or for fear that the other may try to be on the safe side, is allowed for in the second part of the behavior hypothesis immediately following. The second part of the hypothesis is that there is some probability, P sub R, for player R, and P sub C for player C, that the player will, in fact, attack when he elects, or should elect, a strategy of no attack. That is, that his decision will contradict the first part of our hypothesis. This is what was meant by the notion that a player might attack even when he should not. Just what this parameter represents, we shall leave open. It may be taken to be the probability that the player is irrational, or the probability that the payoff matrix is misconceived and that he really prefers unilateral surprise attack, or the probability that somebody will make a mistake and inadvertently send off the attacking force. This parameter for each player is exogenous in our decision model. It is a datum provided from outside. It is not generated by the interaction of the two players. These two parameters, P sub C and P sub R, are assumed to be plainly visible to the two players. There is nothing secret or conjectural about them. This assumption might seem to beg the question we are trying to answer, but it does not. These two exogenous likelihoods of attack do not by themselves indicate what the probability is that the players will in fact attack. They are only one element. The problem is to see whether, given these basic sources of uncertainty, the interaction of the two players' expectations generate additional motive to attack. We have to put at least some data into the problem for expectations and conjectures to work on. The only way to hold the arbitrary inputs to a minimal level is to make these two parameters fully visible. Otherwise, we must state what each guesses about them, what he guesses the other to guess about them, what he guesses the other to guess that he himself guesses about them, and so on. Again, we would have the infinite series of ad hoc specifications with the extra difficulty of dealing with probability distributions of probability distributions. The only way to break clean and to provide a point of departure for calculating what each should fear the other to fear is to make this one basic uncertainty for each player a matter of record. What we want to see is how an objective source of basic uncertainty generates a superstructure of subjective anxieties about each other's anxiety. We now have a situation that looks as though it would generate the compound self-defense situation that we spoke of. The first player must consider whether the other player's likelihood of attack is serious. He must also consider that the other player is reciprocally worried. Even a player whose own probability of irrational attack is known to be zero must consider that the second may attack not only irrationally, but also out of fear that the first, fearing the second's attack, may try to strike first to forestall it. Thus, it does seem as though we might get a compounding of motives. But we do not. We do not get any regular kind of multiplier effect out of this. The probabilities of attack by the two sides do not interact to yield a higher probability, except when they yield certainty. That is, the outcome of this game, starting with finite probabilities of irrational attack on both sides, is not an enlargement of those probabilities by the fear of surprise attack. It is either joint attack or no attack. That is, it is a pair of decisions, not a pair of probabilities about behavior. We work this problem by recomputing the payoffs in the original matrix using the two parameters representing the probability of irrational attack. The upper left cell in the matrix stays as it was. The lower right cell has its payoffs recomputed as a weighted average of the four cells. For if both players choose the strategy of no attack, there is a probability equal to the quantity 1 minus P sub C times the quantity 1 minus P sub R, that no attack will occur, a probability equal to P sub R times the quantity 1 minus P sub C, that R will attack and C will not, a probability equal to P sub C times the quantity 1 minus P sub R, that C will attack and R will not, and a probability equal to P sub C times P sub R, that both will attack. In the same way, the payoffs in the lower left cell are a weighted average of the payoffs in the left column. For if C elects to attack, he certainly does attack, while if R elects not to, he actually does or does not with probabilities P sub R and the quantity 1 minus P sub R, respectively. Thus, with probabilities of irrational attack equal to 0.2 for each player, our original matrix would yield a modified matrix like the one in Figure 20 in the supplement. With probabilities of irrational attack equal to 0.8 for C and 0.2 for R, we get Figure 21. And with probabilities of 0.8 apiece for irrational attack, we get Figure 22. The probabilities of irrational attack in the first of our modified matrices, namely the probabilities of 0.2 for each of the players, prove to be innocuous. That is, they are innocuous with respect to the choice of strategies. They yield a new payoff matrix that still has a strict solution in the lower right corner. The value of the game is reduced for each player, since there is no escaping those two basic probabilities. But the contemplation of the probabilities has not led to their aggravation. Each player has fully taken them into account, has seen that there is still a jointly preferred solution at no attack, and by the original hypothesis has chosen that strategy. The last of our modified matrices, with a 0.8 probability for each player, is symmetrical and unstable. Each player would now rather attack than hope for joint no attack, and each knows that the other one would too. This is a perverse situation corresponding to the prisoner's dilemma familiar in game theory. The only efficient solution would be a binding agreement to elect no attack, which still leaves them suffering the reduced value of 0.04. If binding agreements were institutionally possible and if play were forcibly postponed to give the players a chance to reach such agreement. The second of the modified matrices is also unstable, though not in a symmetrical way. Player C's likely irrationality requires player R to anticipate it by attacking in self-defense. Player C, knowing this, attacks too. The limits to the values of our two parameters, P sub R and P sub C, beyond which they make the situation unstable and provoke joint attack, are letting H stand for the value obtained by unilateral surprise attack, negative H, the value obtained by being attacked while not attacking, 0, the value obtained by simultaneous attack, and 1.0, the value of joint no attack for each player. P sub C is less than 1 minus H sub R. P sub R is less than 1 minus H sub C. Figure 23 in the supplement illustrates what happens to the value of the game for each player and for each strategy, as one of the P's varies from 0 to 1.0. Putting P sub R equal to 0.2 and plotting the values of the game against P sub C, based on the matrix of figure 19, yields values for C and R as diagrammed. At P sub C equals 0.5, the game becomes unstable and the value of the game goes to 0 for both players. That this game does not quite correspond to the original notion of compounded probabilities is exemplified by the fact that we can ignore the lesser of the two parameters if they are unequal. If both are below the critical limit, it does not matter what they are. If one is over the limit by ever so little, it makes no difference whether the other is 0 or 1.0. They can thus be potent beyond what they do to the value of joint non-attack, because they can cause the players to shift from a strategy of no attack to a strategy of attack. But they do so in an all-or-none way. The likelihood of attack either is confined to the exogenous likelihoods or becomes certainty. The game as a sequence of moves in turn. We get the same result if we try a game with moves in turn for the payoff matrix that we have been using. Suppose R is given a free choice to attack or not, while C is constrained to wait, and C can attack only after R has had an opportunity to make his choice and act on it, and only if R has not attacked. We now build further on this game by letting C have a still earlier choice preceding R's, so that C gets a turn, then R, then finally C again. We then give R a still earlier turn, so that R chooses, then C chooses, then R chooses, then C chooses, as long as nobody chooses to attack. What does this game yield? At his last move, C will elect not to attack if the matrix is as in figure 19 in the supplement. He actually will attack then with probability P sub C. At his own last move, R knows what C will elect and makes a predictable choice that depends on P sub C. At the preceding move, C knows what R will choose, takes P sub R into account, and makes a predictable choice. At the move before that, R knows what C will choose to do on both subsequent occasions, takes into account the probability 1 minus the quantity 1 minus P sub C to the power of 2, that C may attack on either of the next two moves, and makes his own choice in a predictable way. And so on. If each player has n moves with probability P sub R or P sub C of irrational attack at each move, the outcome depends on whether P sub C equals 1 minus the quantity 1 minus P sub C to the nth power, and the complex conjugate of P sub R equals 1 minus the quantity 1 minus P sub R to the power of n minus 1 meet the conditions derived earlier. If so, each player knows that the other will not subsequently choose to attack, and himself chooses not to at all turns. But if P exceeds the limit for one of them, he will prefer to attack, and the other knows it, so whoever has first turn attacks at once. In other words, we are compounding probabilities, but still with an all-or-none effect, and without either player having to combine both players' irrationality parameters in the compounding process. Either the probability for at least one of them is big enough and the game long enough to cause the first player to attack, or else no one attacks. And if we make the overall probabilities of irrational attack independent of the number of turns, by letting the probability at each turn be equal to 1 minus the quantity 1 minus p to the 1 over n power, so that the compounded total is just p sub c or p sub r, the outcome of this game is independent of the number of turns. If we think of this game, then, as an analogy of the he-thinks-I-think situation, with each turn symbolizing a cycle in the spiral of suspicions, we have a model in which the successive reciprocal fears of what each other fears makes no difference. Either there is objective basis for one of the players to attack, or they abstain. Reconsideration of the problem. The same seems to be true now if we go back to that burglar downstairs. If he behaves rationally as defined in our behavior hypothesis just discussed, he must consider the likelihood that I will shoot him out of sheer preference, and he must consider that I may shoot him if I think there is a strong likelihood that he will shoot me out of sheer preference. But if we both know what these two basic exogenous likelihoods are, we need not go any further. Either these basic probabilities are sufficient to make at least one of us shoot to forestall surprise, and hence to make both shoot so that the second and higher degree fears are superfluous, or else they are insufficient by themselves to make either of us shoot in self-defense, and we know it and have nothing to fear beyond the exogenous likelihoods themselves. If we both can plainly see that neither would be quite induced to shoot solely out of fear of the exogenous probability that the other really wants to shoot, then we ought to be able to see that neither needs to fear preclusive action, that neither then needs to fear that the other fears it, and so on. But a different situation obtains if I shoot not by calculation, but by nervousness. Suppose that my nervousness depends on how frightened I am, and my fright depends on how likely I think it that he may shoot me, and suppose he acts the same way. Then when I consider the exogenous probability that he may shoot me out of sheer preference, it makes me nervous. This nervousness enhances the likelihood that I may shoot him even though I prefer not to. He sees my nervousness and gets nervous himself. That scares me more, and I am even more likely to shoot. He sees this increment in my nervousness and matches it with one of his own, scaring me further, and the probability that I will shoot goes up again. Now we can denote each person's nervousness as a function of the others, and the likelihood of shooting as a function of nervousness, and have a simple pair of simultaneous differential equations that seem to yield precisely the kind of phenomenon we started off to study. And the reason they do is that this model does not involve criteria for decision. That is, it does not involve a behavior hypothesis that tells us which of two strategies a person will select. Instead, our nervousness model is one in which people respond to the fear of attack by a change in the likelihood that they will themselves attack. Only in this way, by dealing with the probability of a player's decision and not with a rule for decision, that is, not with a model in which the player calculates his best strategy and follows it, can we get the kind of mutual aggravation phenomenon that I described at the beginning of this chapter. Now, does this mean that our phenomenon is not one that can be displayed by rational, decisive players? How can we envisage a player reacting to a change in his environment or to a new bit of information by deciding that he will do something somewhat more probably than before? A rational man may be nervous, in which case our theory is physiological rather than intellectual. But can we conceive of the rational game players taking another look at the burglar and changing the adjustment on his roulette wheel? Of course, individual and group decisions may be different in this regard. We could think of a collective decision by vote, with different members having different value systems and hence different thresholds of reaction to the probability of being attacked, so that the size of a vote to attack would be a function of the estimated likelihood of being attacked. If the vote also depends heavily on chance factors, such as absentees on voting day, the probability of the required majority in favor of attack becomes a rising function of the probability of the enemy's own decision, which in turn is a function of the first collective player's probability. So we can get the phenomenon we want for rational players if we deem rational a collective player that has divergent values and a voting system. There is, however, a way to adapt our model even to the single decisive rational game player. It may be of fairly wide generality in partnership and surprise attack problems, and it directly involves a significant part of the actual problem of military surprise, namely the dependence of decision on an imperfect warning system, and the possibility of both type 1 and type 2 errors in the decision process. Probability behavior generated by an imperfect warning system. Presumably, the danger of suffering a surprise attack can be reduced by the use of a warning system, but the warning system is not infallible. A warning system may err in either way. It may cause us to identify an attacking plane as a seagull and do nothing, or it may cause us to identify a seagull as an attacking plane and provoke our inadvertent attack on the enemy. Both possibilities of error can presumably be reduced by spending more money and ingenuity on the system. But for a given expenditure, it is generally true of decision criteria that a tightening of the criteria with respect to one kind of error loosens them with respect to the other. To require less evidence of incoming attack before retaliating is to require more evidence that they are really seagulls for holding back our planes. But now we can have a model of a rational decider who responds to an estimate of the probability of being attacked not by an overt decision to act or abstain, but by adjusting the likelihood that he may mistakenly attack. One's response to an increase in the probability of being attacked is to shift the criteria for decision that are used in the warning system in the direction of lesser likelihood of a failure to respond, and hence in the direction of greater likelihood of a false alarm that provokes one's own retaliation. If each player's response to an increased danger of surprise attack is to enhance his own proclivity toward inadvertent attack, the probability of each player's attack is now a rising function of the others. Such a warning system is the rational mechanical counterpart of our nervousness in facing the burglar. To build such a model, symmetrically for simplicity, we can again let H denote the value of winning a war. Minus H, that of losing a war. 0, the expected value of simultaneous attack, 50-50 chance of winning or losing. And 1.0, the value of no war at all. This time, we can let H exceed 1 as long as the quantity 1 minus R times H in the matrix represented in figure 24 in the supplement remains below 1. But if winning gains a pyrrhic victory, H will be a small fraction. We assume that successful surprise wins the war. Successful surprise means that one attacks when the other does not, and that the other's warning system fails him. Let R denote the reliability of a player's warning system, that is, the probability that an attack, if it comes, will be identified and surprise forestalled. Then the payoff matrix is as in figure 24. The probability that a player will attack when he should not, that is, that he will when his rational choice should be against attacking, in the sense used earlier, will consist of two parts. One, denoted by A, is the exogenous likelihood of irrational attack. It excludes the possibility of an attack provoked by false alarm. The probability of an attack through false alarm is denoted by B. Thus, the two types of error in the warning system are represented by B and the quantity 1 minus R. And the main feature of the model is that B equals F times R. F prime times R is greater than zero. That is, the more we reduce